This is my first time speaking in the new building. Kind of excited about that. It's nice. I apologize for mangling the announcements a little bit ago. I thought to try to add some value there, and that got me in trouble apparently. But anyway, the song we just sang, 10,000 Angels, we sang that, you may have recalled, I don't know if you do or not, I do because this happened to me. Jason called me a few months ago when he was doing the Lord's Supper, and he asked if I would lead that song before the Lord's Supper one day, and I did, and I thought that his thoughts were very insightful on that subject, and I kind of asked if I could use what he had said there, and he was gracious about that. And so this lesson is kind of based around the idea found in that song and the idea that he had gone into in his talk at the Lord's Supper on that day. The song 10,000 Angels refers to Matthew 26:53, where Jesus says, "Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels?" As Ron pointed out before the song, he asked if he could do that. That worked out fine for me. The number's way more than 10,000 for 12 legions of angels. It's a huge number of angels, and it called to my mind a preview for a movie. I'm telling you, I only saw the preview for the movie because I want you to know I didn't go see the movie. I have no idea if it was a good or a bad movie. I think it was probably a horrible movie. The preview is pretty bad, but every so often I go and watch interesting previews and just to see what's coming up, and this was like a year or two ago. And there was a movie that came out, and it was called Legion. And in the movie, it's supposedly about the earth. God is fed up with the earth, and he sends legions of angels to go and destroy the earth, to go and cause, to wreak havoc. And the movie's centered in this small diner out in the middle of nowhere, and there's these clouds of angels that are coming down, and the humans are battling against them, and there's only a handful of the humans battling against all these angels. And there's one, I guess Michael, he's been somewhat rebellious. You know, it's Hollywood, so they do all this silly nonsense. And he's been somewhat rebellious, so he's on the human side. And so it's several humans and him faced against all these angels in this overwhelming thing. And I wondered, you know, how they could make a movie that would last that long about how short a battle that would be. Because this is kind of typical, right, of Hollywood, and how little they understand, how little they realize the power of God, and the fact that how powerful are angels, how strong are angels. In 2 Kings 19, starting up in verse 8, we find in this passage that Hezekiah is under attack from the Assyrians, the most powerful empire of the time. And this kind of goes on for some time. The Assyrians come in, they kind of lay siege to Jerusalem. God causes the king of Assyria to get a report, so he leaves for a while. But right after he leaves, it says here, "The king heard concerning Tirhaka, king of Cush. Behold, he has set out to fight against you. So he sent messengers again to Hezekiah, saying, 'Thus shall you speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah. Do not let your God, in whom you trust, deceive you by promising that Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands, devoting them to destruction. And shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered them, the nations that my fathers destroyed, Gozan, Haran, Rezeph, and the people of Eden who were in Telassar? Where is the king of Hamath, the king of Arpad, the king of the city of Sepharvaim, the king of Hena, or the king of Eva?'" So at this point, since we're reading the Bible, this looks like he's mocking God, and indeed he is. But if you look at it from the king of Assyria's viewpoint, he doesn't know who the true God is. And he's got this little tiny nation that's a thorn in his side, few cities, and he's going to come and step on them like a bug. And they are, at this time, the world's superpower, right? They're the world's great empire. They're ascendant. And everything that comes into contact with them dies. Every nation that comes up against Assyria gets crushed. And every nation at this time is not, it's not the nations like us, where people nowadays, they may say, well, if you go up against this country or that country, they're very secular. We have very secular countries. But no, these nations of that time, they all had gods. They all had these gods that they worshipped. And so the king of Assyria is making what, in his mind, is a good point. I've gone up against a lot of nations with a lot of different gods. And none of them have done anything to stop me. And you better believe that those people were praying like crazy to all those gods when Assyria came up against them. Assyria had a horrible reputation. Absolutely awful. As a matter of fact, the empire finally falls when Babylon, when Nebuchadnezzar's father allies himself with the Medes and with a bunch of other people that have been stepped on and have been crushed and have been brutalized by the Assyrian Empire. And they finally rise up and overthrow this terrible empire. Certainly no ancient empire was good, but the Assyrians' reputation was horrible. The book in the Old Testament that regards the destruction of Assyria, of course, this is not Jonah, right? Jonah gets sent to Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, but they repent when he comes. But later on, another prophet prophesies regarding Assyria, and they don't repent then. And that's the book of Nahum. And I love the last verse in the book of Nahum because it really gives you a taste of what everybody thought about Assyria, really. Nahum 3, verse 19 says, "There is no easing your hurt. Your wound is grievous. All who hear the news about you clap their hands over you, for upon whom has not come your unceasing evil?" So everybody was going to rejoice. The fall of Assyria caused no tears at all. No one was upset about this empire falling. And the Syrians' great brutality, I was telling the kids one time in class, you know, the Syrians, what they would do is they would march in, they'd annihilate some land, and they had the same problem that all empires do with conquering some place, is that you worry about people rising up. And so they would take all the people that were left, the survivors, the lucky ones, and they would move them into some other place, and they would transplant some other place in there. So when the 10 tribes fell, which is just prior to this passage in 2 Kings, the 10 tribes of Israel already fallen to Assyria. And they have already been transplanted out. So already a chunk of the Israelites is taken away. Now it's no longer, this is the split nation, right? It's no longer the Jews are in Jerusalem, but they've seen the people that they knew, the people that they lived near, the other tribes are now gone, and Assyria took them away and transplanted them with other people. So the Samaritans, the ones who come in after that, are not the 10 tribes of Israel. They're people that the Assyrians transplanted from someone else. And so there's this great fear that is happening now. And, you know, it's easy for us to look back because we know the end of the story, but when you're living there at the time, imagine the fear that they must have had. This mighty empire has finally come up against them. And previously, when things like this have happened in other kings, I spoke one time, I think it was a Wednesday night invitation on what Ahaz does in a similar situation. He actually reaches out and says to another empire, calls to Egypt and says, "Hey, you need to come save me from these guys. Here's some money," right? And usually that's kind of the geopolitics that you play. But Hezekiah doesn't do that. He doesn't go play geopolitics. He doesn't call up Egypt and say, "Hey, you're my southern neighbor. You don't want me to fall because I'm the border nation. Why don't you come up and save me," right? And push up against Assyria. He doesn't do that. If we continue on in 2 Kings 19, Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord. He goes up to the house of the Lord and prayed before the Lord and said, and he spreads it out before God. He prays before the Lord and says, "O Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see and hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their lands and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they were destroyed. So now, O Lord our God, save us, please, from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Lord, are God alone. So Hezekiah understands the real bottom line here, doesn't he? He goes, and he doesn't call up a fellow nation, doesn't call up his friends, his allies. He goes directly to God and says, look, you're being slandered here. It's funny because he even says, he can see it through the king of Assyria's eyes. He knows Assyria has crushed all these other nations. But he also knows that those other gods were not gods, right? But God is different. He's living. He's not a god of wood or stone or metal made by hands. So continuing on in verse 32, therefore thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city or shoot an arrow there or come before it with a shield or cast up a siege mound against it. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return, and he shall not come into the city, declares the Lord, for I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. This is kind of a continuing theme in the Old Testament where when they finally do trust in God, a lot of times he just does the battle himself. And this is one of those times where Hezekiah doesn't have to field an army. 2 Kings 19, verse 35. And that night, the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when people arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. Okay, 185,000 soldiers of the most powerful empire of the time, overnight, dead. So how many angels did that take? 10,000? 1,000? 100? 10? It says, the angel of the Lord. One. It took just one angel to do that. We are so insignificant compared to the power of God. And the angels themselves are insignificant to the power of the Father, right? And so when we think of that, we have to understand that Jesus saying he could call 12 legions of angels, right? That, it wouldn't just destroy the world. He could just annihilate the universe. And of course, since he was the creator of it anyway, then he probably could have done that just with a word. He probably wouldn't even need the angels to help him out. It wasn't even something that was required. We know, of course, through the book of John several times that he gets cornered, the people are going to stone him, and then he just escapes, right? He just walks through the crowd. So he doesn't even need to call angels. He doesn't need to call other people. He doesn't need to phone home for help. He just needs himself. That's all he needs. So the title of my lesson is actually, what could Jesus have done? But I want to go through several things here, right? So what could he have done? A few weeks ago, right before we left to Italy, I kind of got this all polished up and done then. And I'm sitting there, and Mitch started the first of the lessons, the three that he concluded today. And he kind of went over some of the areas that I'm at already. And I turned to Lynn, and I said, he just did it. He just annihilated my entire sermon, just like that. And he didn't even need an angel to do it. And she said, well, that's okay. You know, maybe it's okay to repeat things. And so I said, that's fine. Okay, so I had already written the thing up. We were going to leave. So that's why we're headed down this path. So some of this will be a review, okay? But we're going to go some of the same places that you've already been in the last few weeks in Mitch's class. I mean, in Mitch's sermons on Sunday morning. Let's go now to Matthew 26. 47 through 53. Let's read the actual passage here. It says, while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a great crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, the one I will kiss is the man. Seize him. And he came up to Jesus at once and said, greetings, Rabbi, and he kissed him. Jesus said to him, friend, do what you came to do. Then they came up and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword. And we know that's Peter from one of the other accounts. Struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. Then Jesus said to him, put your sword back into its place. Okay, so just imagine this picture here. Put yourself in this place. So remember that the disciples were hoping for an earthly kingdom, right? We know that that's true. Even later, even after Jesus has died and raised again, and that he says to them, he's speaking to them in Acts, and they say, "And are you going to restore the kingdom now?" So they don't even understand until the last bitter moment exactly what the kingdom of God is. But now they've seen Jesus. They've seen him walk through crowds of people who were trying to stone him. They've seen him feed 4,000 people, 5,000 people. They've seen him heal people. They've seen him raise people from the dead. They've seen him out on a boat in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, tossing in the storm, say, "Peace, be still." And they've seen this, everything drop, right? They've seen all that. And still, I don't know, Peter's excited. He gets to be part of the army. He gets to draw his sword, right? Like his sword is even needed. Like, he's even needed. Why would he even be needed to do this? Okay, so out comes these people to arrest Jesus. He draws his sword, cuts off the ear. It must have been quite a meal. I always try to picture that he dodged and just got his ear whacked off the high priest's servant. But anyway, Peter whacks off his ear, and Jesus says, "No, put your sword away." And then he says to him, "Don't you think I can appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels?" So he kind of asks Peter, "Remember who it is that you think you're defending. Remember who it is that you think you're helping here," right? 12 legions. John 18, 3 through 6. This is one of the, this will be a complete review from 2 weeks ago. Okay, so Mitch went over this one 2 weeks ago. I missed last week, so I don't know if he went over it again last week, and then it's going to be even more review. But anyway, we'll go to John 18, 3 through 6. This is John's account of the arrest. "So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, 'Whom do you seek?' They answered him, 'Jesus of Nazareth.' Jesus said to them, 'I am he.' Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. And Jesus said to them, 'I am he.' They drew back and fell to the ground." Okay, so the part of the passage here that's rendered "I am he" is just egoimi, right, in Greek. So for some reason, sometimes, like John 8:58 is a good example. Remember that that's the end of the passage where Jesus has been having a pretty escalating argument with the Jews. And it's gone back and forth and back and forth, and the allegations get more and more and more, and they accuse him of being a spawn of the devil, and he basically tells them, "No, you're the children of the devil. Your father was a liar, and he lies since the beginning." And they said, "No, our father was Abraham." And Jesus says, "Abraham saw my day and was glad." And they said, "What? You're not even 40 years old, and yet you say you've seen Abraham." And they're laughing and backslapping. And he says something that calms them all down and makes them look for rocks, which is, "Before Abraham was even born, ego eimi." He says, "I am." And almost every translation will render that one just "I am." They don't say "before Abraham was born, I am he" there, because it just doesn't make as much sense. But it still sounds weird, because when Jesus says it, "before Abraham was born, I am," of course what he's doing is looking back at Exodus 3:14, right? I mean, he's looking back at the name of God, at what the name of God is. When Moses says, "What am I going to tell the people of Israel? Who am I going to say sent me?" And God's going to say, "Tell them I am sent me to you," right? Because God is self-existent. He's the source of being, right? And so that's what Jesus says there. He connects himself back to the Father there in John 8:58. Well, he says the same thing right here in John 18:3-6. So you could read this passage this way. He says, "Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, 'Whom do you seek?' And they answered him, 'Jesus of Nazareth.' Jesus said to them, 'I am.' Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, 'I am,' they drew back and fell to the ground." Now, why do they fall to the ground? They fall to the ground of worship is what they do. They're forced to their knees by the power of God. Do you think they would have fallen to the ground on their own? No. I mean, so maybe the Jews who were in the mix, if they heard him say, "I am," like that, I don't know. Maybe they would have fallen to the ground out of shock and blasphemy. I don't know, looking for rocks. Maybe that's what they were doing. But the Romans, they would have not fallen to the ground. But the whole group of them falls to the ground, right? And I've always pictured this like this, right? So they fall to the ground, and then they're getting up because they don't know why. They don't know why they fell to the ground. They're like dusting themselves off and picking up their clubs and torches that are, you know, lighting bushes on fire, whatever's going on. And they're looking at him kind of in a dazed shock, because that's what must have been what happened. And then, and when they're looking at him, now he says, I asked you, you know, who you're looking for, and I told you I'm he. Why don't you get to business? And I picture him kind of looking at you like, well, okay, you go that way. You know, we'll be right behind you. Right? That's what I was picturing. Because, I mean, you know that if you were forced to bow before him, would you want to arrest him? Would you want to even be in the garden with that guy? I wouldn't. Right? So that's the power of God. There is no, and 2 weeks ago when Mitch went over this, he made this point very clearly that Jesus gave himself to them. There was no power on their part that they could bring to bring him if he had not willed it to be so. He handed himself to them. It was him. It's not even as though we say that he did it completely willingly. Sometimes we might say, a guy did this horrible thing, he held some hostages up, the police came, and he went with them willingly. That makes it sound like there was, you know, some negotiation that went on. Jesus didn't need to negotiate. He didn't have to. This was what he had come to do. This was the point of him coming. And the falling to the ground and the I could call, you know, 12 legions of angels, those things are really just to tell every human being there, you're not in control of the situation. I'm in control of the situation. Christ was in control of that entire situation. So now we have this picture here. Christ says he could have called and God would immediately have put at his disposal more than 12 legions of angels. Although it only took one to slaughter 185,000 Assyrian troops overnight. And yet he doesn't. So that's what could Jesus do. But what did Jesus do? What did Jesus do? We know what he did. He went to the cross willingly. That was, you know, that's why we have the Lord's Supper. That's what Jason, you know, the talk at the Lord's Supper, that's one of the common themes that you find in the Lord's Supper is that he went to the cross willingly. This is something that he did on his own. This is something that he did without our involvement, without our help. He didn't need Peter's help. He didn't go to the cross because Peter helped him. He didn't save the world because Peter helped him. He didn't save you because a man helped him, right? He saved you on his own. And he wasn't forced to go to the cross. In other words, Pilate didn't help you, right? And the Jewish leaders, they didn't help you either, although you're saved by Christ's crucifixion. No, it's all him. That's why those passages are there, so that we understand that there's no one else in this mix. There are some who come out now and will say things like, well, Christ didn't intend to die. That this was an accident. He had come to be an earthly king, but it was too soon. It was too soon for that. And so then he had to, you know, he died, but it was sort of a temporary holdover, right? Until he comes back later on, because he had, I don't know, he had to go get reinforcements or something. I'm not sure what the story there is. Or maybe he needed more people to help him. Right. What's funny to me is, you know, on its face, and you guys are giving me the looks, you know that that's heretical. That doesn't make any sense. That's obviously unbiblical. But it's more than unbiblical. It's not more than unbiblical, but it's unbiblical to its utter core because it's completely counter. It's got to be satanic because it's completely counter to everything in the passages that talk about him. The whole purpose of the passages is that he is doing this on his own. He's not helped. He's not harmed. This is all according to plan, right? In the chess game with the devil that's going on right now, the moves are already made. They're already written down somewhere. He already knows what's going to happen. He already knows which way he's going to go and how he's going to die and who's going to deliver him. And it's all foreordained and it's all according to plan and it's all according to his plan. And it's not Peter's plan and it's not Caesar's plan. It's not Pilate's plan. It's not the Jewish leader's plan. It's not anybody's plan but his. It's not even the devil's plan. It's his plan, right? So at this point here, if we go to Philippians 2, 5 through 8, This is a common passage you'll hear read at the table. Philippians 2, 5 through 8. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And again, in Hebrews 5, 7 through 8. So hold your place in Philippians, because I'm not done with that passage, and I'm not going to be done with Hebrews either. I want to go to Hebrews 5, 7 through 8, though, because I'm stopping just short of something with both these passages here. But in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. I can't remember my times yet, but Craig was up before Jason, I think, and or maybe a month before that, and he was doing the table. And Craig even said one time that Christ asked the Father, he prayed to the Father to be released from this, right? And he wasn't. He wasn't released from it. He says, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but thine be done, proving that it was the will of God. Of course, he already knew it was the will of God. He prayed that prayer for us. That prayer was in the Bible for you and me to read and to understand, not because he was confused about the will of God. I mean, other passages make it perfectly clear that he knew he was going to the cross. So he prays that because he wants everyone everywhere to know that this is the will of God, right? So he prays this in the days of his flesh. He offers up prayers and supplications to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reference. He was heard, okay? He wasn't saved from the first death, but he was saved, right? He was raised up from it after 3 days. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered, right? So he goes to the cross willingly, and not only, so this is the word I want us to focus on here as we go into the last section of the lesson. What could he have done? What did he do? What did he do was obey. He obeyed. He obeyed his Father. He submitted to the will, the shared will, mind you, of the Godhead. He obeyed. Now, that's not something we typically think of kings and emperors and, you know, even presidents. We don't think of the guy at the top, right, obeying anybody. But he obeyed, right? He was obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Both those passages end with the obedience there of Christ. They're not done yet, but that's where they kind of truncate. And that's why I wanted to hold you both those passages, right? Because there's the second part of that is the, as we have, what could he have done, what did he do, and what should we do, right? What should we do? His obedience means that we must obey. So if you're still in Hebrews, because that's where we went to last, Hebrews 5:9 says, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Do you see the way that obedience curls in on itself? So he's obedient to God, right? But we follow that example. We are then obedient to him. And that's how we gain eternal salvation, right? That's how you gain it. You gain it through obedience to Christ. And his obedience is that example unto God that gives the example to us so that we know what it is that we should do. Now, if we go back to Philippians and finish that passage, in 2 and continuing on in verses 9 through 11, therefore God has highly exalted him. So remember the verse in Hebrews, he was made perfect through his obedience. Here, God has highly exalted him. Why? Because of his obedience. Bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Now that one says something slightly different, okay? And this leads me directly into the invitation. So the passage in Hebrews says that he's the source of eternal salvation for everyone who obeys him, right? That's here and now. Here's the deal. Everybody's going to bow, and everybody's going to obey him. Do you understand that? See, that's the thing that a lot of people never, Hollywood never puts this in. They never understand. And a lot of people, they don't really cognate how that whole thing works, right? There's this sort of idea that there's a consistent and continual rebellion. There's that you could be, and this is maybe a little bit why Hollywood kind of enjoys this, right? Because they kind of like to flaunt the notion of evil. And so the idea that even if you go to hell, then there you can be a big rebel too, right? And that there you can refuse to bow. You'll refuse to bow here, and you'll refuse to bow there. No. You will bow. Everyone and everything will bow before Christ. The question is when? The question is when will you bow? Will you bow in this life? Will you bow in this life and gain eternal salvation? Or will you bow later on before you're sent to eternal damnation? Right? Do you see how that works? So you're going to bow. Right. There's not going to be anything. You're not going to run into some person that you work with who's a cranky atheist and is constantly talking about how there's no God, and then he's going to get up and he's going to say, oh, there's no God, and even after he's dead, he faces God. No, he's going to be on his knees. But at that point in time, weeping because he knows now what he's lost. You, on the other hand, though, you who've been baptized, you who have repented, you who have believed, you who have followed what it says that you should do, will have this incredible hope, this amazing happiness. Because now you'll know, you'll be bowed too, right? Bowed down as well then in those days. But you'll be bowed down thinking, I'm going to heaven. This is it. The great happiness and the great joy. And yet other people will be bowed for a different reason and with a much more different feeling. Most of you, we've all been through some schooling here, right? And did you ever do this thing where you studied really hard for a test, and it was a grueling test, and you took the test, and when it was done, because tests always end, that's the great thing about tests, right? They're done. At some point, no matter how bad you do, they are done, right? And you get to the end of the test, and there's this feeling of, I did it. I passed that test, right? And you know you did a good job. You know, you nailed it. But all of us know, if you ever had that feeling, sometimes you look at your friends or somebody else, and there's the same thing. The test is over. Somebody, put your pencils down. Put your pencils down. You're done. People are collecting papers. You're finished. But then there's some people that are like, pencils down. Yes. That's the people who obeyed Christ here, who bowed the knee here. There's some people, though, who have that sinking feeling. You look at your paper, there's scribbled marks, there's empty chunks of paper, and I've lived this personally because there was a lot of tests that I didn't do very well on. And so, there's this despair, this cold despair that you know you failed that test. And when it comes back, maybe you'll get a D. Maybe. Maybe you'll hope for something that's not a big fat F on your paper, right? And that's the feeling of the person who bows too late. Who bows after this life has ended. If you're here this evening and you haven't bowed while here, you will bow eventually. You may think, no, I won't. I'm an American. I don't bow before anybody. Right? This is not earthly rulers we're talking about. This is a creator of all that exists, the source of eternal being. This is not only that creator, though, but a caring creator, a personal creator, a creator who cares about you. He wants you to worship and to obey here. He does not will that any should perish. He does not want anybody to bow too late. So if you're here this evening and you haven't been obedient, you need to come forward. You need to be baptized. You need to bow here and now before it is too late. Before that sinking feeling of despair comes and takes hold of you. Because you know at the end times, at the last days, that your God is displeased with you, that you failed the test, and that you have nothing but an empty future to look forward to. Nothing but damnation is waiting for you. If you need to remedy that, would you please come now as we stand to sing the song that's been selected?